Good day, everyone. Before we move on to our episode for today, some of few announcements. This episode is sponsored by Mrs. Bean Coffee. So, Matt, what can you say about our new source of caffeine?
Well, we are very excited to have this brand because Mrs. Bean Coffee sells locally grown beans from the Cordilleras and Mindanao. So, it comes from our very own Philippine soil. And they sell different kinds of blends such as Sagada, Arabica, Benguet, Kalinga, Robusta, and Premium Barako Iberica. And they also have flavored drip coffee. So they have flavors such as vanilla, mocha, caramel, and my personal favorites, butterscotch and Irish cream. And the other good thing about it is they come at very affordable prices. But those prices are about to be more affordable if you use the special code reserved only for PI podcast listeners. So para sa mga ka-PI lang. So the code is Mrs. BXPI. That's MRSBXPI, all capital letters. And you'll get a 15% discount voucher when you order your Mrs. Bean coffee. And it is available in Shopee or on Facebook. We have links to both. So please follow them in Facebook and Shopee. So tara na, kapiyan na with Mrs. Bean.
And now we proceed to our regular programming.
Welcome to the PI Podcast, Political Insights for the Palaging Inis. I'm your host, Matt, and with me is my co-host, meme scientist and political lord, Bored.
Okay, that was unexpected. To an extent, yes. I'm about to study memes.
He studies memes and he's a political lord.
PI nyo, PI nating lahat. Or share at your service.
Yes, and we have this very special episode. We have been having a lot of content lately, but we felt it was really special. So after the Bonifacio Day special, we have the Hannah Arendt special. We're celebrating her death day. So parang sinasan to nat. So St. Anna Arendt, panalangin mo kami. My goodness. So before we move on, Borge, what, you know, we have a lot of respect for Miss Arendt. Miss Arendt, well, what is your relationship with Miss Arendt? Well, relationship.
Bakit pakinggan?
Bakit pakinggan?
Hannah Arendt was married, you dipshit.
So ikaw yung kabit.
Gag.
My goodness.
Okay. Again, a few decades ago, our society lost, well, our human society lost one of its most incisive thinkers, Hannah Arendt. What's my relationship with Arendt? Well, it goes a long way to an extent. You know, I remember spending my undergrad in the library reading her works. But to be one more clear thing is that the first book that I bought with my own money was Arendt's On Revolution. But then again, you know, to be honest, and I think this would be a warning to our listeners. At first, I could not digest her arguments regarding revolutions because, again, I was still trapped within the usual Marxist framework. And she eventually, she obviously worked against the usual Marxist notions of revolution. So it was challenging. So it took some time for me to mature before I started reading Arendt again. So, I think she's one of the thinkers that have influenced me more. I don't want to call her a philosopher again because Arendt herself would have a beef with philosophy and she would like to be called a philosopher as well. And she said that explicitly. She's a political theorist.
But what is the difference between a philosopher and a theorist then?
It depends on the topic. And Arendt, to an extent, accused some political philosophers of relegating key notions like freedom into the level of individuals, when in fact she revived it, as we will discuss later on, that freedom is essentially a collective thing. So she has a beef with some philosophers, and she learned much from philosophers. And if you have read Marx properly, then you can also see the influences of Marx, even Karl Jaspers, Heidegger as well, Arendt's work. What about you? When were you first exposed to Arendt?
Exposed to Arendt? Well, like many of my influences, I was exposed in Ateneo de Manila University. I have a very, to say the least, strained relationship. But one of the things I did appreciate is really, Arendt actually is quite a popular theorist in Ateneo. It's not only used in political science, political theory, but also in my philosophy classes, and to a certain extent, some literature classes. So their influence in particularly in like political thinking in particular, or at least the political thought, is quite popular. And not only here, but I think a lot of the philosophy professors imported Arendt from the liberal colleges and universities in United States. So she's also quite popular in American universities, where she herself taught and toured and lectured all after being exiled from Germany, you know, as a Jewish philosopher. And, you know, weirdly enough, while I was, many of my peers were grappling with Marx, I wasn't always comfortable with Marx. And she was one of the few that actually critiqued him quite effectively, and it stuck with me today. So that led me to, I think the first one that I read was not on revolution, but I think was Human Condition. And our professor had us read the preface of the Human Condition, which is like the earth is the quintessence of human existence, which means it's the only, this is the only planet, and this is the only way, the only way we exist, you know. So and she compared it to going up on the into space, and that's when we finally realized that it's the only world we got. So it's the planet that we share, and that's a very deep and poetic message. And it's weird because he only, I think most of us only read the preface, but eventually I read the entire book more than once, The Human Condition, and then of course, which led, we also read On Revolution, like you did, as well as Origins of Totalitarianism. So I think for one course, it's a full course meal of Hannah Arendt. And so for this episode, we want to share our love with of Hannah Arendt with everyone. So spreading the gospel of Hannah Arendt.
No. But the thing is, we're not really spreading the gospel. You know, one
I think that's
thing,
the point. Yeah, you're right.
One thing
she
that,
wouldn't appreciate the gospel.
Her dissertation is on St. Augustine, of course. So I need to find that one. But you know, one trigger that we had in organizing this episode is that we are actually observing increase in sales for Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism.
Right. So
when we are rummaging through secondhand or, well, you know, firsthand bookstores online, we would see people piling up trying to get Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism. And there's a growing interest. But as I've said, there's also a danger in, you know, misinterpreting Arendt. So she is, to an extent, she transcends partisan lines, and her ideas constantly resist being appropriated. So, So I think one of our goals here is to not really set the record straight, really, but to elaborate on key concepts.
And not only that, I mean, of course, I actually felt that because it took, I've been eyeing for a copy of I Commit in Jerusalem, one of her one of her most famous works. Yeah. And it took me like months because people keep grabbing the copy. And for some reason, I Commit in Jerusalem. Why? It's, well, that's, it shows for the popularity. And I think it kind of asks us, like, is Hannah Arendt applicable to the Philippine context? And that's why we appropriately named this episode Arendt in Manila.
Yeah.
So what can we learn from Hannah Arendt as Filipinos with our current situation politically and socially, you know? So, and of course, in particular with political thinking, you know, Hannah Arendt is highly original, despite getting a lot of her foundations from the Greeks, you know, she actually critiqued her German peers, Nietzsche, Marx, and even her ex, who, and she's actually famous for this, for being the kabit,
or someone,
or the girlfriend, the lover of Martin Heidegger, who is a famous German philosopher, who's also a Nazi. In fact, that should be a part of a film. But no, but anyway, there we go. But yeah, but she not only critiqued the popular German philosophers, you know, that were slowly becoming more popular even in the American continent, but she also tried to talk about thinking itself.
Yeah.
So she's thought about thinking. And so we'll see what we can learn about thinking, especially, and compare it to how the Philippines can learn perhaps how to think a bit deeper, okay, or think better. But Borg,
think more critically would be more apt.
Yeah. So, but before we get into the thoughts of Hannah Arendt, let's try to contextualize like what Filipinos think about thinking. And I think it's I think it's clear that we have a very mixed record and relationship with thinking. So number one, we usually equate it with, of course, education, you know, and most people bemoan the fact that, number one, a lot of students underperform, you know, when the international average is usually in standardized tests, it's about 400 plus. We are right there, the 390. So it's still below the average. And so it's usually the quality of education. And by extension, it has caused people to not perform as well in their jobs. Mm. And of course, they extend it to the logic of, you know, the phenomenon of bobotante. Hindi sila edukado, kaya ganun sila bumoto. Kaya nananalo yung mga tao katulad ni Erap, katulad ni Duterte. Dao, sabi nila. That's why certain populists win, because they usually bemoan the lack of education and, of course, the lack of thinking. And that is why that there's also an emergence of quote-unquote thinking class. In fact, there is a page known as the thinking class in the Philippines. Like, what the hell? How pretentious. And there are also groups like the Filipino Free Thinkers, which has been, well, which grew out shortly before, of course, the RH bill. A bunch of like people that were normally restricted and were frustrated by the conservative society, you know, so they were a group of atheists. And of course, you have the Get Real Philippines blog website, which talks about like having an educated stance, you know, and saying that, oh, this is what we should do, you know, so wake up Philippines, things like that. So Borge, how can you comment on this parallel phenomenon? And maybe do you have anything to add with regards to the Filipinos' relationship to thinking?
Well, you already said so much about it to an extent. Well, the current conditions. Mm-hmm. But, first and foremost, Arendt's contribution to political theory and we can say that to philosophy itself is, it's not only about her arguments on politics per se. Her primary contribution is focused on how to think. How to think dangerously, and I think we can end with that one later on. But what can Arendt say about our case, and what can I say about it right now? Okay, we can start with the latter. What can I say about this growth of or this proliferation of thinking in public discourse? Again, first and foremost, as you rightly said, this is a backlash against the Bobotante discourse. So this is one thing that should be broken apart, and I think Arendt would agree, but it is not a license for people to simply think without any sense of discipline, without any sense of depth, without any sense of self-criticism. And I think that is what Arendt pinned down in many of her works, some essays in Thinking Without the Banister, if you want to check that out, her essays on Introduction to Politics as well, that thinking entails not only about looking outside, but also looking at our own judgments, at our own prejudgments, examining our assumptions, whether our assumptions are still true or not. And are Filipinos, do we have a culture of thinking in such a way? That's the thing. Magmuni-muni would be one example.
That's the band too.
Yeah, goddammit. But magmuni-muni, or to ponder on things. And, that's one part that I think is can allow us to think deeply, that gives value to thinking deeply. But then again, we have parodied thinking itself for philosophers. We have philosophotage, the usual image of an absent-minded man. So we have a mixed relationship with thinking. And and as far as I'm concerned, as far as Psikolohiya ng Pilipino is concerned, we value thinking if it's only translatable into something practical. So thinking is only of value to Filipinos if it is practical. Will Arendt agree with such a thing? What do you think? Will Arendt agree with will Arendt agree with thinking as something that's supposed to be tied with something practical?
You know, it does include that, but I think as we'll get into her thought later on, I think it does not necessarily need to be practical. In fact, in some ways, it can be a passive activity. But so I think that's what we want to challenge here. And I think the other thing I was trying to mention is does thinking necessarily require a complete education? Because precisely because these groups lord over votantes or value their own works or their own words and their thoughts, precisely because they're more educated than most. They finished their education, sometimes with advanced degrees, and therefore, again, they bemoan that most of the country did not finish their education, or even if they did finish it, if they come from a public school, they usually snobbily reject them, you know, and they're not up to par, which to an extent is actually objectively sad. You know, it's, we have an objectively bad education system because of lack of funding and lack of reform. So that's another thing we can talk about later on. And of course, we've already touched on with JM in our previous episode. But I want to ask you this, though. Yeah, does thinking necessarily require education?
It depends on what type of education. Education figures in Arendt's framework more as a venue for people to practice thinking. But thinking, I think, for Arendt is something that can be, that you don't need to have formal education with, first and foremost. But thinking for Arendt appears to be more of a habit. And if you would say that habits are formed by education, not necessarily formal, but at least we go to the Confucian idea of self-cultivation in order for you to form habits, I think that will also be open to that idea. So there's a line between thinking and education between Arendt. They're distinct for her. At the very least, thinking and education are distinct for Arendt.
And I just want to quote this from her main work on thinking. I mean, she talks about thinking across her works, but her main authoritative text is The Life of the Mind, which is unfortunately an unfinished three-volume work. But the first thing when she talks about thinking, one thing she says is, what are we doing when we do nothing but think? When we normally always surrounded by our fellow men, are together with no one but ourselves. And in fact, you know, she even said elsewhere that, yeah, thinking is kahit nakatunga ka lang. So, you know, we can talk more about that later on, but thinking can be passive. You know, thinking can be done even in isolation. So, yeah. But
yeah, we'll elaborate more on that one later.
We'll elaborate more on that later.
Because
that
thinking is tied with her concepts, key concepts, her key take on politics. So you really cannot separate thinking from politics. So I think now, before we move on to thinking further, we can look at some key concepts that she tackles.
One important concept is her distinct definition of what the political is. And she normally talks about relating it with politics and freedom, in that you can only be free in relation to each other. And this comes from her work. Her lecture, The Freedom to Be Free, and people can only be free in relation to one another. And so, and she further goes to say that you can only be free in politics. Can you elaborate on this further, Borch? Have you encountered this concept with politics and freedom?
Regarding politics for Arendt, as far as her introduction to politics is concerned, you can find that in The Promise of Politics, along with her examinations on it in The Human Condition. But it appears that for Arendt, this is something that I must make clear to our listeners before you start reading Arendt. Politics for Arendt means two things. And again, she's defining it based on classics. So that's a disclaimer that we must make. Arendt, as a political theorist, is a classicist. Not classicist na, you know, class superiority, but classicist in terms of going back to the classics. So for her, politics means the realm of appearance. You know, as far as ancient Greece and ancient Rome is concerned, this is the place where people make themselves appear. Okay, make themselves appear in public via their speech and through their action. So she goes back to the old Aristotelian notion of language, logos, as both language and reason. So politics as this realm of appearance. So there are things that do not appear, and those are things that are in the private sphere. That's why she reasserts the distinction between public and private. And again, we go back to our old episode of everything is political. So we said that everything can be politicized, and not everything is political, because there's always a realm that does not appear. Okay, does not appear. Okay, so
This what is are the things that do not appear?
Well, first and foremost, your biological structure.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you show to the public your x-rays, no one would fucking mm-hmm. know. So yeah, there are things that are essentially not appearing, but in order perhaps for you to, what?
A more important distinction, like, for example, mm-hmm. your dynamics with your family, people need not know about it.
Yeah.
And yet,
unless magawi ka sa kalsada.
Unless, yeah. So these are also for interpersonal, mm-hmm. but they're not necessarily political. And I think that's what we have to reassert, despite, well, we've already talked about this in our PI Raw, everything is political, but it's not.
Mm.
It's, she makes that distinction that mm. what is political is public. And mm. just to go back, and I think the as politics being related to freedom, she also says that eventually we go into politics in order to be free from politics. So part of being politics...
Wait.
It's part of here. Yeah.
No. I need to correct you on that. That's one thing that she criticized.
Mm.
Politics is freedom.
Yes.
It's just not an escape from politics.
Okay.
That's one thing. Okay. Regarding politics and freedom for Aaron, mm-hmm. they're one and the same. Mm-hmm. To act in a free sense is to be political already. It's mm-hmm. to make yourself appear. Now, this mm-hmm. is a criticism of two things. First, right. The criticism of the argument that politics is a necessary evil that we can avoid and that freedom mm-hmm. is freedom from politics. That's one thing that she criticizes.
Okay. Right.
It's not that one. So, uh-huh. and the other one is criticizing the idea that you can actually escape from politics through by being free. That's the liberal mm. argument that freedom mm. is the realm that is outside politics.
Yeah.
So she criticizes both and says that mm-hmm. as far as the classics are concerned, politics mm-hmm. is freedom. So,
and she gets a lot of it from, of course, the Aristotelian tradition. Mm, so yeah. that's important. With regards, so what does he, how does he again define the public and private? Now, why is this important? Hmm. Why make this distinction? Why not say everything is political? Because I think that's what, we've mentioned this before, but by collapsing the distinction between public and private, you know, people tend to say that, oh, you definitely have no choice but to be political. That's why they make that frame so that they can convince you to be on their side. And it is... Yeah, yeah. You know, it's for your own benefit, you know, for your own survival sometimes. Yeah. But why this distinction?
Why this
according
distinction?
To Aaron? Mm.
Well, this is a reflection again of, well, her understanding of Athenian politics, which is there are parts of society that are hidden and that those hidden are basically the basis for one to participate in politics. Mm-hmm. So the household would be there, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I think what you are trying to pin down would be the next... The essence of politics for Arendt, which mm-hmm. is politics is freedom. Politics is the realm of appearance.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing that she argues is politics is based on plurality, that there could mm-hmm. be no politics without plurality. Mm-hmm. And that plurality, to an extent, is something that a person shares
mm-hmm.
and a person harnesses or something that emerges out of the private realm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm trying to remember which in particular, but she also says that, and this made actually made me a bit emotional when I read it, in that each individual is unique and has the potential to create something new.
Hmm.
And that capacity to create something new is the basis of her theory of action.
Yep.
So action is being able to do something that's new and has not been manifested before. Yep. So, and she contrasts that to perhaps... the society that's not free when people act just like
everyone
one another
else.
When there is a uniform thought, you wear the same thing, you think the same way, and I suppose that's what elections do, especially right now. And I think I'll give an example. Perhaps the fact that there are not that many undecideds is because our society is so so polarized that they've already picked their sides one way or another, probably because their parents or their friends or their workmates even support a particular candidate, you know, they feel pressured to do so. But for Arendt, you know, that's related to her thinking, which we will talk about later on, is that it's trying to manifest one's own thoughts even. That's making your own, it's funny thing, it's about manifesting your individuality.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
That is the Greek ideal that Aaron mm-hmm. reasserts. To be political is to act freely, and to act freely is to do or to have the capacity to do something new. That's I think that's the indicator that she pinpointed in order to measure what freedom is. Freedom is the capacity to do something new, as far as the Greek standards are concerned.
Right.
That's how you appear when you create something new. And that's also an assertion of your individuality. So the thing is, I think you can agree with this one, that for Arendt, there must be a balance between individuality and the collective pursuit of what is good.
I do have a question, though. I mean, we know that the Philippines does have a collective culture, the thing about bayanihan and pakikisama. Well, they both have positive and negative traits, like to the point where, like, okay, it helps people, you know, join together, band together, having a common good time, you know, an agreement and consensus, but also to the point where sometimes when the collective does something bad, the pakikisama na lang, or sometimes when you have, even when you have been wrong, you kind of put that aside. So what do you, is there, do you think that there might be this tension between this collective inclination in Philippine culture with Hannah Arendt's thought and individuality, which is quite Western?
I think no, because even Arendt did not resolve the conflict between the individual and the collective in her in her thinking. She leaves that to politics itself. So she has enough decency not to resolve such a fundamental problem only by thinking about it. She leaves it to the actual activity. So if we have contradictions right now between individuality and collective behavior, that fits well in Arendt, because Arendt would say that let the contradictions run its course. You don't you don't need to repress it. You don't need to repress either individuality, or you don't need to repress collective behavior. Because that's the point of politics. Is this is the field, this dynamic field wherein the individual and the collective interact, you
know? And negotiate.
Individuals negotiate with one another. They can negotiate with the collective itself.
Well, not necessarily, but precisely when the boundaries of the individual and the collective will are negotiated. As long as there's that interaction, then that's political. Okay. Now, regards to that collapse of the public and private, I suppose we can move on to the next important idea. And I think this is one of the best-selling books, to the point where it is constantly available and even prominently featured in Fully Booked, which is The Origins of Totalitarianism. And it has a great cover, by the way, but let's not judge it by its cover. It's still great. But so, of course, she used this to discuss the emergence of anti-Semitism and the rise of Hitler and the Nazis. So what is her, what's her diagnosis of this phenomenon, which was unprecedented, actually? What does she mean by totalitarianism?
I think we already brushed aside. We already brushed upon it a while ago regarding the repression of things. So again, politics is founded on freedom, appearances, and of course, plurality. But totalitarianism for Hannah Arendt is this anti-political tendency wherein you collapse the public with the private, you politicize everything, and by doing so, you repress plurality. You try to make everyone the same. So totalitarian movements, yes, Arendt recognized that it is violent, can be violent, but the essence of totalitarianism lies not in the mechanisms of repression, but in the rationale. And for Arendt, and this is something that she exposed, the rationale is this. You eliminate plurality. You resolve the contradiction between individual and collective by eliminating differences. So,
That comes from that root word of totalitarianism, which is it's totalizing. It part of being made part into a whole. So there is no more difference. And that's what she, I think this she tried to conceptualize what she's been fighting all along. Of course, she herself, as both a German and a Jew, she, in a way, come to think of it, to be a German and a Jew at the same time, is trying to resolve, like, part of you is oppressed another part of you. And she also talked about, like, her people on why did people commit such atrocities to her, to the Jews. When trying to resolve that, you know, totalitarianism reduce the Jews' humanity completely. And I think the weird thing about when I was reviewing the origins of totalitarianism, it's weird. It's totalitarianism and power. I think I'm paraphrasing here. Mm. It's no longer about convincing people. It's just merely a matter of organization. Do you know about that line?
Mm. Yeah.
So you don't have to convince people. That's weird because it's part of like assuming it as fact that the Jews are to blame for Germany's slow growth and poor conditions because there's a conspiracy and therefore they must be destroyed. And it's the Nazi party that is meant to bring forth this change of history. So do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, that's for the case of the Nazis. But Arendt also tackled the case of Stalin's Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So while Hitler reduced everything to the issue of race for Stalin, reducing everything to the issue of classes. Mm. So you try to create a single class state that is totalizing on one hand. Mm-hmm. Classes,
right.
One class is just one part of a society.
Mm-hmm.
But the crucial thing is about that one, it's not only it's totalizing, it also represses plurality, that you cannot be anything other than a worker.
Mm-hmm.
And what it veils is that there's always someone who is more powerful. That's the thing about totalitarianism. How is it different from authoritarianism, first and foremost? Authoritarianism is you have the authority, everyone else is equal. So everyone else is equal, but you have the single authority above it. Mm-hmm. But totalitarianism is just flattening out everything into a single category. And you know, the implications of this one, as far as the politics in Soviet Russia is concerned, is to an extent savage. Not only in terms of killing people, but in terms of the toxic relationships among even the elite. So if everything is flat, everything is up for grabs, you simply just can eliminate everyone at a whim.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else, and this is something, everyone else is just there to watch. So,
but you know, I think the allure of this tendency is it simplifies everything. It makes everything black and white. It makes everything straightforward. And in a way, it removes the necessity for thinking.
It removes the necessity for doubt.
For doubt, even. Doubt is very much related to thinking. So, and you find these kinds of simplifying tendencies in Philippine culture or in Philippine politics? Is there manifestations of totalitarianism?
Do we have a totalitarian movement in the Philippines? Do we have a totalitarian movement in the Philippines? I think I can leave that to our listeners. You can answer that one. Do we have a totalitarian movements?
There are comparisons of Duterte and Hitler, and Hitler was an identified totalitarian movement, you know, well, at least him and the Nazi party, according to Arendt. So do you think the DDS is, and even maybe even the Marcos apologists, can they be considered totalitarian?
Anyone who tries to repress diversity and demean anyone else can be guilty of totalitarian tendencies. So I will not reduce it to the DDS and to the Marcos apologists. Anyone who would try to demean the individuality of someone, or anyone who would try to demean a certain sector for the sake of, uniformity or whatever they think is right. So that's the thing. When you close negotiations to what you think is good and what is right, you are eliminating politics. And by trying to eliminate politics, you are going along a totalitarian path. Because again, let me repeat for our listeners, to those who haven't read or just totalitarianism. Totalitarianism is an anti-political tendency. You eliminate politics. You don't respect politics. You see politics, it's diversity, it's mess. Politics is messy, Jesus. Even Arendt knows that. It's messy. The contradiction between individuals and collectives, among collectives, among individuals, it's messy. But when you try to eliminate it, either by strongmen or by a sense of righteousness, if you try to eliminate it, you are walking along the path, the same path trodden by the likes of Stalin and Hitler. Do we have totalitarian tendencies in the Philippines? Bahala na kayo dyan. I'll leave the audience to judge about
and
that.
Just and just to balance that out, there's even this, I think we talked about this before, this slogan that emerged. And it's a good thing that Lenny supporters kind of bash this. It's the "I think, therefore I think" slogan. And it even has the University of the Philippines ablation which logo, which is like, oh, mga taga UP, nag-iisip, kaya, ano, kay Lenny sila. But I'm like, well, the fact that you reduce all thinking people to think for Lenny is simplifying things, you know. I mean, that's actually a terrible thing to think about, you know. So
it's a terrible thing to preach. It's not only thinking, they actually preached it. They actually have a tarpaulin for it.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. Yeah, and it's weird that the Filipinos questioned even their candidates. You know, can you argue that what's going on with elections is multiple totalitarian movements competing? That could be.
That's a possibility. That's a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. But regarding what you said, that Filipinos can actually criticize their own candidates. Just a brief tangent.
Yeah.
Filipinos have the great capacity to excuse their candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this capacity to excuse is in part based on what you said, that we do criticize our candidates. So before we excuse them, we criticize them. Mm-hmm. So do we have totalitarian movements in the Philippines? Is the upcoming elections based on totalitarian tendencies?
Mm-hmm.
We have yet to see, but
Arendt
would probably say that, or would probably pinpoint whoever is trying to eliminate politics, trying to eliminate the mess of politics by simplifying or absolutizing or reducing something to, you know, just a single category or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Right. Actually, it could be, I think you and I talked about this before, but even totalitarianism can manifest itself even in liberalism, don't you think? Is there such a thing as a liberal totalitarianism, or maybe among progressives?
Well, a recent study by Pippa Norris and Ronald Inglehart actually recognized that even liberals can be autocratic in a sense of being intolerant, being domineering, and trying to, you know, regulate ideas circulating around. So totalitarianism as a tendency is not exclusive to an ideology. That's one thing that is clear in Hannah Arendt's work. It is not exclusive to fascism. It's not exclusive to Nazism. It's not exclusive to socialism. It's a tendency. And even the most liberal of all ideologies can actually be infected by such a tendency, as long as they're trying to eliminate politics. For example, if you have a technocratic ideology, if you want intellectuals to lead the country and eliminate politics altogether, that is totalitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you want or a milder version of it, is that all discussion should be exclusive to those who quote-unquote think, then that is also anti-political.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there's this common... this is a common thing that's emerging right now. It's called tapos nang usapan. Like even in something like hindi corrupt si Lenny, tapos nang usapan. Or even that's what Bongbong Marcos said. It was like, mga kasinungalingan lang yan, you know, tapos nang usapan. You know, like I've already disproved that, you know. And that's what they use. So the tendency to shut debate down on certain topics is in itself one aspect of totalitarianism, if not totalitarianism itself. Yeah,
it's tempting. It's actually tempting to end conversations.
Mm-hmm.
It is. We need to recognize that one. If you're pissed off about, you know, end mindless discussions, mindless debates, or endless debates, it's understandable. You know, I will not condemn anyone who is pissed off by such instances. And we have had enough of it. You know, as a society, we have had enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
But to say that to eliminate conversation itself, people must be aware of the costs. You know, people must be aware of the cost. If you say that tapos na ang usapan, yet you still claim to represent freedom, you're either delusional or an idiot. So, you need to be aware of the cost. So if you're willing enough to say na tapos na ang usapan on certain issues, then you are threading the path of anti-political tendencies.
In fact, I think it has been embedded in our culture, the fact that sometimes, perhaps even in Filipino parents, I think you and I are blessed with parents who aren't as authoritative, but it's a typical Filipino parent that says, "Oy, respetuin mo yung mamatanda or something." So you can't even talk back to your elders, which is not exclusive to our culture, but it's part of that tendency. But again, politics is all about discussion, you know. And I think that's we have to also recognize that Hannah Arendt says that the relationship among citizens is among equals, which means that that's of course from the Greek ideal, wherein you can talk to each other and even criticize each other as equals, regardless of rank or age. You know, that's the beauty of politics. You can be equalized.
But I think that should be, you know, that's one of my misgivings about Arendt regarding her arguments on equality. Theoretically, yes. But we must have mechanisms to ensure that that level of equality actually exists. So you have, we go back to civic education would be there. Actual, and this is a problem that's already been tackled by succeeding theorists who pondered on how can you base politics on a conversation of equals? Then you must have equalizing mechanisms in place. Maybe education, maybe economic equalizing mechanisms, political equality, so on and so forth. So I think Arendt left that out as far as my own understanding is concerned. So she assumes that it is an ideal. But again, equality right now is more of an ideal than a reality for men. So that's also a challenge for anyone who are trying to base their arguments on Arendt. That's a limitation that she has, really.
You know, it's I just remembered, like, having these conversations as equals, you know, framing it as equals, and which we've discussed in episode 3, check that out if you haven't, is that it's even been promoted by Jordan Peterson, which is weird. Like, it's about being able to steel man each other's points. You know, you should be able to even strengthen the point of your opponent. So to recognize the truth within their argument and to understand, of course, the truth of your own, you know, because if you don't, I'm trying to remember who said this, but if you don't understand the opposite side, you don't understand your own side. So that's one of the rules of Jordan Peterson, like, assume what the other person knows something you do not. You know, and that's one equalizing tendency, which is perhaps philosophical, you know, and personal. But it's difficult to bring up in politics. Lalo na kapag galit na galit ka sa taong yun, sa ibang kampo, sa ibang kandidato, na parang... So try to find the truth in that person, you know.
And you know,
kahit yung mga BBM or DDS, di ba? Nakatunahan ba sinasabi nila, di ba?
And you know what? Again, that's the blind spot in Arendt's theory. Her take on equality and political equality is a bit, you know, more too idealistic and not realistic enough. And I would not blame anyone who is pissed off at the other camp because the other camp says bullshit. I will not blame them. I would not blame either camp. I would blame the education system that have failed to provide this equalizing mechanism, which is you provide people with similar capacities in analyzing reality. So some people have lopsided capacities to analyze reality. Some have better capacities to analyze reality. It's not their fault. It's the fault of the education system. So, indeed. So,
I mean, she's talked about education so far, but I think the education system has yet to incorporate what Hannah Arendt defines as thinking. And I suppose we can start with our final segment, which is, what does Hannah Arendt think about thinking? We kind of already said that, wherein it's both, it can be an active process, which means you can actively think, and it can also be quite passive, which means kahit wala kang ginagawa, nakatunga ka lang, it's nag-iisip ka na, which in a way highlights the man's capacity to think as a thinking creature. So, Borge, what do you remember about Hannah Arendt's more precise definition of thinking, besides, of course, being both active and passive?
No, I think that would be it. But for practice, in practice, and I think this would be her contribution, how can you practice thinking? What's the appropriate way to think about reality? So I'm looking at it from now, from the book, Thinking Without the Banister, these are essays in understanding. So if you want to check it out, I'm looking at the letter that she wrote to Robert Hutchins. And the first part of it is that, how unconstant do you think about certain things? So how do you draw conclusions from reality? So She says, and I'm going to quote, I therefore am inclined to believe that the best order to follow is the one drawn up by reality itself. That means you start with what is real, you know. But then again, the first part of that one, she's responding to her previous argument, which is you do not settle with appearances. You need to go to the essence of things. And this is something that she got from Marx. You know, that's why I said that Marx's influence on Hannah Arendt to an extent may be observable. You need to go to the essence of things. So you start with the surface. Yes, that's fine. You start with how things appear. But you need to go to the essence of things. For example, if you're pissed off about someone's wrong facts, you know, someone spouting out fake news, fine, you can start with that. Say that that person is spouting out fake news, but you need to ask why and how. So that's going down, that's going deeper. Is that person spouting out fake news to support an idea, to support an advocacy, or just plain and simple trolling? So you need to ask that one. But for Arendt, you need to go as deep as attempting, I would quote this one, it may be possible to attempt the otherwise forbidding task of re-examining basic ideas and traditionally rooted concepts. So you try to go to the essence by more or less questioning the very concepts that you're using. The very concepts that you're using. And we parallel to this one, she gave an advice regarding, I think this is what one of her primary contributions on judgment, even if that's an unfinished project. But from The Promise of Politics, when she discussed the issue of prejudice, prejudgments. So for Hannah Arendt, we have judgments. Okay, we have prejudgments. We have assumptions, and everyone shares a prejudice. She spares none. Not because we're all defective, but for Arendt, prejudice is a necessary thing to handle reality. You simply cannot deliberate all day, all night. Okay, you are armed with certain prejudgments, certain assumptions that have been built upon experience. Okay, so for Arendt, in order for you to think deeper, you need to examine whether your prejudgments are still factually correct, whether your prejudgments are still reflective of reality. So you need to constantly examine that one. And the dangerous example that she provided would be how to handle prejudice against race.
Yeah,
and she argued that if you want to handle prejudice, or, you know, I'm going to quote it because it's according to her, one of the reasons for the power and danger of prejudices lies in the fact that something of the past is always hidden within them. Upon closer examination, we realize that a genuine prejudice always conceals one previously formed judgment, which originally had its own appropriate and legitimate experiential basis, and which evolved into prejudice only because it was dragged through time without its being re-examined or revised. So basically, at the core of a prejudice lies a certain truth. So for Arendt, I would quote this one. If we want to dispel prejudices, we must first discover the past judgments contained within them, which is to say we must reveal whatever truth lies within them. If we neglect to do this, whole battalions of enlightened orators and entire libraries of brochures will achieve nothing, as is made eminently clear by the truly endless and endlessly fruitless efforts to deal with issues burdened with ancient prejudices, such as the problem of the Jews or of Negroes in the United States. So that's how you handle prejudice. You recognize that there's a historical truth behind it. And that is irritating for many people. So yeah.
Sinulat mo yan, no? Nagbabasa ng script ka. No,
no. I'm actually reading from The Promise of Politics right now. I just know where to find it. And that's usually my advice to my students. You don't need to memorize shit. You just need to know where to find shit.
So have a bookmark ready. I actually, well, I remember even in the human condition, she distinguishes two important things, which is vita activa, being, of course, active in the public sphere, but also a balance with vita contemplativa, which is the contemplative life and the necessity for thinking. You know, and this is often, well, this is also a possible pitfall wherein there's a usual misgiving with regards to thinking that perhaps you can be paralysis by analysis, or you can be stuck in your ivory tower. But she also recognizes the need for that, because even with In the Life of the Mind, she says that a lot of thinking has to do with making present, which is something that is absent. In other words, you play around with concepts that are not necessarily there. So it's even using your imagination. And even she even says that that mathematics is simply playing around with numbers. You know, you're not talking about like one mango or two bananas. You're just talking about ones and twos and ideas, and you're able to say how they interact with one another. So, of course, this is thinking with abstract concepts, maybe metaphysical ones, but this eventually they are applied in real life. You know, that I think there's a necessity wherein thinking needs to be separated from everyone else, and that you're able to have that conversation with yourself. That is often when you have that moment of criticizing your own arguments, your own prejudices, even if you're not necessarily in the presence of, say, for example, that racial minority you dislike, or that opposing party you dislike. Perhaps you should be able to prepare for their arguments even in their absence. So that's the fair point of thinking. You know, even if in their absence, you should... That's training, you know, of thinking.
But I'm just curious. Do you have any prejudices that you were able to break?
Prejudices I was able to break. Well, I normally have prejudices against woke students, you know, and every time I see a video about screaming university students with colored hair and... colored hair, gender ambiguous pronouns on their handles. You know, it's like, oh, they're probably these people who are, again, who promote their progressive politics in a totalizing and simplifying way. But at the same time, it is fun to actually talk to them and saying, normally I just respond, are you sure? And I just watch them like just get flustered, because it's clear that sometimes they haven't examined their own thing. Because I just asked a student, we're talking about sexual harassment, and then there was a claim that saying all women are being sexually harassed every day. So that's a very totalizing, simplifying claim. And I just said, are you sure about that? I said, yes, sir, it's a fact. I said, according to who? So, of course, that process at least allows me to think, oh, they're just people who are just learning to think, you know. And the fact that, well, that's because of my, that's combined with my capacity as a teacher to know that students are still learning. With regards to prejudices, to be honest, like even with regards to other adults, I don't really have that many prejudices. So there's not really a lot to break. But I am actually even curious as to, I have an empty slate, actually. And I said, what is going on? Like, how do you think? That's what I want to do. I want to talk. And I suppose that's part of like my tendency to want to have that conversation. You know, that's like thinking in dialogue and thinking in public. You know, I think we need to have that attitude or that habit as political people to think in public, to make sense of something and allow yourself to make mistakes in public. So because that's because you're trying to make sense of things with your fellow citizens. So I don't know. I mean, if you're trying to ask me about prejudices, I can't think of any except for woke students. But again, that's balanced out with my attitude as a teacher. So
again, the definition of prejudice for Arendt is just a prejudgment. So isn't the prejudice behind your want to talk to people is a prejudgment that you actually assume that they actually want to talk. Isn't that that's a prejudgment? Not all people are capable of talking, like, you know, talking intensely and such. So isn't that a prejudgment? Anyway,
Well, it's a tabula rasa. If I try to talk to them, I talk to them, and we'll see. You know, I don't assume anything.
You assume that they're willing to talk, I think.
if they're not, then they're not. But if you assume that they're not, then that is your assumption. You know, so that's your prejudice then.
But honestly, just to mess with you.
Ano ba talaga?
Because you spoke of someone else's prejudice, not yours. Anyway,
I do have a prejudice towards people with prejudices. Yeah,
but you know, for my case, you know, something that I had to make peace with was, you know, my prejudgments against elites. So again, I think that prejudgment is still alive right now.
Oh, clearly,
it's qualified. So I need to I need to recognize that there are democratic elites. So that's reality telling me that elites can be democratic, but most of them are not. So they can be, but most of them are not. So you just cannot trust elites with the democracies. But some of them you can. Some of them you can. Most of
again,
them.
Remember, you called Bonifacio an elite, despite him being a father of our nation, ideally a republic. Yeah.
But again, it's allowing which elites to. It's allowing reality to the nuances of reality
play
to
out
affect our assumptions.
Actually, that to be honest, it's a real prejudice, not with students, but even people on. Again, I've gone into Twitter just to get into the fray, you know, in, down and dirty. And there are people I do talk with people with their pronouns on their handles, and there are some people who are capable of talking back. You know, and they're not just students with. Slogans. There are people with who can talk with experiences or their anecdotes from people they've talked to. So there's always someone with something to say on the other side. You know, something of some substantive to say. So I don't know. I don't know. I've begun with always with that assumption, but even I'm surprised sometimes when you think that this person is non-binary. It's like And you'd expect them to say the same slogans, but in fact, they process it themselves. So you can trust even in them that there are people who are capable of defending themselves.
Yeah.
Because it's weird, like to be forced to defend your own, for example, gender or your own economic class, it is offensive for some people, but some people would be able to stand their ground. And I think that's a product of being practicing thinking, of contemplating and reflecting on their own life. I think that's something we can learn from Aaron. You have to contemplate on your lives because you don't always get to talk to people that don't agree with you. In fact, that can be dangerous sometimes when you actually talk to them, like maybe a DDS, and say that you don't like the third. That can be very dangerous, especially to certain relationships. If you're trying to keep up with relationships, you know, not maybe among family members or among friends. Anyway, so yeah. I suppose. We can that's go with... thinking, you know, that's so any final thoughts on Hannah Arendt and political thinking? So what can Hannah Arendt teach Filipinos in the way that they're thinking? Is there much to learn for Filipinos with regards to Hannah Arendt?
There is. Arendt in Manila is basically Arendt appealing to our you know, to our want to think and our even our capacity to think. We can, you know, Tupo Botante is just one of the bullshits created by totalitarian liberals. But we can think, but we judge thinking based on practical matters. But one thing that we can do to intensify how we think is to think dangerously. And I think this is one of the primary things that I've learned from Arendt, in reading Arendt, is dangerous thinking. And dangerous thinking is different from thinking about dangerous stuff, because anyone can think about dangerous stuff, you know. Anyone can think about taboo or just some dangerous issues. You can think about it, but it doesn't mean that you're thinking dangerously. But what does it mean to think dangerously? To think dangerously for Hannah Arendt, and I think this is reflective in what I have quoted a while ago regarding prejudice. Thinking dangerously is about, it's a two-way thing. First way is you look out, okay? You look out and you spare none from criticism. And I think this is something that she shares with Marx as well. You spare none from criticism. Even the most widely held argument or concept, even if it is a traditional concept, even if it is something popularly shared, doesn't mean that it's right. So you need to subject it to criticism in order to assert it. That's why I think she got flack with Eichmann in Jerusalem.
Yeah,
because the popular opinion at that time was Eichmann was the embodiment of what is evil, along with the Nazi regime. Yet the banality of the banality of evil, and she exposed this reality by going against popular opinion, and she shows that Eichmann was merely doing his job. So evil itself can it's not about morality per se, but it can be a political structure. And this is something that this is a reality that she exposed because she went against popular opinion. So.
Right.
So that's one part. You look outside, you spare none from criticism. You just spare none. And that goes back to ourselves, which is you don't spare yourself from criticism. So your prejudices, they're useful. Prejudices are not necessarily good. They're not necessarily evil. They can be evil if and only if they're no longer aligned with reality. So we need to constantly check if our assumptions are correct, if our assumptions are still aligned with reality. So that's dangerous thinking. You know, if even if you think about dangerous stuff, I mean, I'm already attacking the left right here again.
Yeah, okay.
Activists, leftists, they think about dangerous stuff all day. And I applaud them for that. They they think about it and they, to an extent, act in response to it. But can they question their doctrines? Can they question their dogmas? Can they question their own traditions? So yeah, and again, Mao would come in. Self-criticism isn't necessary. You need to wash your face every now and then. So even Mao would reflect on such matters. So dangerous thinking, just for our listeners, dangerous thinking is not about the object that you are thinking about. It's about how you think.
You know, just to continue on that, Eichmann in Jerusalem is famous for the concept of the banality of evil, wherein evil is not necessarily always the radical, violent acts, you know, but mostly just being refusal to think and just follow orders, because that's the common line that the Nazis on trial were doing. They're just following orders. And she was trying to expect this villain, but it was just an ordinary person. Well, it's funny. Like in the movie, she said it's a human being that refused to be a person. A person is capable of thinking, and if when you refuse to think, and you know, you relinquish your humanity, and therefore you're capable of doing anything. So that's something very poetic that is present, like in Hannah Arendt's thought. But at the same time, it's not necessarily when you criticize, therefore you find something wrong. It's not necessarily just to destroy it, because sometimes when you hear criticize, the word criticize can be violent and can be very have connotation. We're comfortable with that. But really, I think one thing that Hannah Arendt highlights in her own thought is, again, the preservation of plurality, and which in the space called the world, called Amor Mundi, which is love of the world. And the world is where we live together and share a common system, a common structure, a common public sphere. So we have to debate each other in order to live with one another. We only know how to live with one another if we talk and work out our difference. Wow. Napaka fluffy naman yung pagbalansing sa'yo. But that's the point. It's not criticism just to tear people down, but in order to build a world together. But sometimes that involves, I don't know, it involves giving and taking, you know, with one another. So that's part of being compromised. So it's weird. Like when you see some of her interviews, she said she is not capable of love except for her love for friendships, you know, or her friends.
Right, the friend zone.
But maybe Heidegger broke her heart, but really, but I suppose that's one love she's capable of, which is, you know, with the political sense, love in the political sense. Although in general, love in romantic love, she believes is not, is apolitical and it destroys politics. But yeah, I suppose Amor Mundi is, she's trying to search for that kind of love that preserves the world. That's Amor Mundi. So perhaps what we can do moving forward is, of course, criticize ourselves and criticize each other relentlessly, but in order to build a common world together, not necessarily to tear each other down. Because, of course, she fought against that violence. And violence in itself, people think that violence is political, but it's precisely the opposite.
It's anti-political.
Violence is anti-political. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah.
So I think that's a big one.
Verbal violence or physical ones.
I don't know. That's more than an hour of at least summarizing Aaron's thought about thinking. and how it can be applied to the Philippines, you know. Actually, it's Philippine. One last thing on Philippine culture. Yeah, I think a lot of Philippine culture bypasses talking. Ayaw tayo mag-usap tungkol sa politika. Wag na yung politika. Like even in group chats, it's like, wag na yung politika. In family, in dinner table. But I suppose Hannah Arendt kind of pushes us to do that and saying, let's talk about it, but also in in a cordial way, at the very least, even if you can relentlessly take down, you also know that there are people there. So, shall we move? Yeah.
Yeah, regarding
what do you
that,
say about that culture?
Some last points regarding that culture. Again, that must be qualified by general data that Filipinos are not, they're not afraid of talking about politics. So they're not afraid. So we do like to talk about politics. But then again, selective instances, kwentuhan, inuman, politika yan, pero we also have spaces.
Kahit sa barbero, di ba?
Yeah, kahit sa barbero. So we're not afraid to talk about
politics. Sa
grab
driver mo, di ba?
Yeah, kaya nga, that's why we can learn much from Aaron because we are not afraid to talk about politics. Filipinos are not generally afraid to talk about politics. That's why we can learn much from her. Another thing regarding, I think we mentioned this one during our pre-prod, that Arendt is breaking down an ivory tower. So what she is establishing is an acropolis, you know, they say above the forum, but still tied with the forum. So it's a place for us to just stop talking for a while, go up to the acropolis and start thinking before we go down again to the forum. So
instead of an ivory tower, which is really high and inaccessible, it fits other people, you know.
Yeah.
You can talk to people, you can, you know, wrestle with ideas. That's the metaphor. So umakyat din tayo. That was magsama-sama tayo at mag-usap. So yeah. It's very Greek, despite her being a German Jew.
Now we go up and think. Then we go down to the forum and start speaking. Yeah, so Greek.
Is the Acropolis? I'm confused. The Acropolis is supposed to be collective, right?
It's also collective. But you're there not really to speak, but to think and worship the goddess of wisdom. So it's a place you speak and you negotiate in the forum.
Actually, they also talk also in private, right? Yeah. Like you mentioned that we usually talk in spaces. Like, well, it's a private thing when you have your haircut.
Yeah.
You talk with your in the privacy of the grab or taxi.
Yeah.
But sometimes we also have to. So that is in a way pre-political.
Yeah.
Where you can have these conversations to practice thinking, and then you
can
do that in the public sphere.
Yeah.
So it goes both ways. I think it's a problem with democracy in a way. We leave that talking with our representatives. We ourselves can do that. We ourselves can talk to our politicians. Okay, so that we can go on and on, I'm bet.
Yeah.
But let's move on, I think, let me do recommendations. I mean, we've already recommended. Okay, we're recommending more Hannah Arendt stuff.
I think I don't think we have any separate recommendations. I think we can just recommend the entire list.
So we talked about the human condition, promise of politics, origins of totalitarianism, and
thinking without a minister.
And the life of the mind. But I think additionally, of course, it's not very readable, but it adds context. The Eichmann in Jerusalem,
we
talked about the banality of evil, where she almost canceled.
Yeah,
I do want. Okay, there's this also, they also sell this one, Freedom to be Free. It's quite cheap, a Penguin Classics. It talks, it includes three lectures on the topic. And I'd also want to highly recommend, might you disagree with this, the movie Hannah Arendt.
Yeah, go ahead. Know,
where she has this great speech, especially in the end, where, of course, she defended what she had to say about Eichmann. And she was against not only her students, but also the Jewish community and fellow Jewish professors. So, and she held her own in saying that, this is very important. And I think this is a very important quote. Understanding is not the same as forgiveness. She tried to understand Eichmann as a Nazi, but that doesn't mean she forgave him. And that's what they thought. When trying to explain Eichmann, they thought you're trying to humanize him. In a way, she did. But does not do away with the evil that he's done. She understood how he was able to do such evil acts. So I think that's an important thing we have to do.
Yeah.
We have to understand, but that doesn't mean that you necessarily forgive people.
Yes.
You can understand Marcos apologists, violent kakampinks, and DDS, but it's a duty to understand them, but not necessarily forgive them.
We are treading on dangerous paths where liberals would argue with that again. But you're right. Can we recommend something that is not Arendt but related to Arendt?
Go ahead.
I can recommend. I will recommend a book by her ex, Gaga.
Is her Nazi ex boyfriend?
I'm recommending. If you can find a copy, I think there are some available. But
there are a lot.
Martin Heidegger's "What Is Called Thinking."
Mm-hmm.
So in this book, I think this book was written post-war, and Arendt provided a blurb for it.
Not too bitter.
Both Heidegger and Arendt shared this love, not only for the classics, but also a love for thinking. And in the book, Heidegger posited the question, are we actually thinking? So yeah, I would leave that to our listeners. So even Heidegger himself argued, are we actually thinking? And then he says, I know that you would answer yes, but let us go through it. So yeah, I'm recommending that one, a book by your ex.
Well, her response there is that we think whether we like it or not. The important thing is to think dangerously, as we said, or think effectively. But of course, it's important to get a debate. I think it was a question that he brought up first, but Arendt, in a way, elaborated on. We think whether we know it or not. So that is it for this very special episode on our intellectual idol. But of course, I think we criticized her to a point.
Not idol, intellectual inspiration or influence.
Influence. I didn't yon P. I put influence. Like, she's special to us. Hopefully, she'll be special to you as well. And there's a lot to learn from her. Even if they're not your political influence, there's always something to be had or to be gained from reading her. And we hope you enjoy it the same way we did, or maybe to any extent whatsoever. And so, yeah. The PI Podcast can be found on YouTube, Anchor, and Spotify. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions regarding our show, please email us at pipodcastph@gmail.com. But until the next episode,
magandang gabi, mga ka-PI.